There used to be a saying among Soviet intelligentsia, to understand each other with half words. So what is shared is silence or a tone of voice, a nuance of intonation. This peculiar form of communication with half words was a mark of belonging to an imagined community that existed on the margins of official public sphere. Hence, the American metaphors for being sincere and authentic, say what you mean, or go public, or be straightforward, do not translate properly into Soviet or Russian contexts. Saying what you mean actually could be interpreted as being stupid, naive, or not streetwise.
Writer and filmmaker Svetlana Boehm. She'll be back in just a moment with more about everyday life in contemporary Russia. Welcome to Soundings, a magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Major funding for this edition of Soundings comes from the Modern Language Association of America, which encourages the teaching and study of language and literature. Understanding Russian politics and culture has always been a challenge for Westerners, especially so since the so-called downfall of communism. But a new book by a Russian-born writer and filmmaker brings some fresh insights. The book is Commonplaces, subtitled Mythologies of Everyday Life in Russia. The author is Svetlana Boehm, a professor of humanities at Harvard University. She says that because we call them commonplaces, the ordinary circumstances of everyday life don't at first seem important in helping us to understand the patterns of how a culture works. But when she recently returned to Russia after a lengthy absence as an exile, it was precisely those commonplaces that revealed so much about the real Russia. Here's Svetlana Boehm.
It was actually quite a story. When I went back in 1989, my friend met me at the airport and asked me how long am I staying. I said, well, probably 2 weeks, to which my friend responded, I'm afraid you'd only stay 1 week. I asked why. He said, in a week we're expecting the end of the world.
It was that intense, that sense of...
I realized that I am back in Russia and there is no way of having just a small polite talk and ask, hi, how are you, and answer, I'm fine, thank you. Really, the whole mentality was sort of thrown back at me. And I think what is the subject of my book and what interests me are precisely those long-lasting cultural myths and ways of cultural communication and often miscommunication.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel yourself that you were in a strange land, a stranger, even though you're a native-born Russian and you were going back after an absence of only 8 or 9 years? That isn't really such a long time. Yet you found yourself at odds with your native culture. How about that?
Yes, I didn't know where I felt more at home, in America or in Russia. And of course I speak Russian and Russian culture is my culture, but I think by now I'm a person of two cultures and I don't want to choose. But what strikes me is that in America, in a way, you could be hyphenated American. You could be Italian American, Russian American,
Asian
American.
But not in Russia.
Not in Russia. Uh-huh. So people would react to me saying either that I didn't change at all or that I'm completely Americanized, but I felt that I was neither.
Let me ask you to step back from the personal, Svetlana, and talk more at the level of public impressions. Because this country and Russia were enemies for so long, politically and militarily, are Americans still entitled to that sense of strangeness and otherness and foreignness that it's been customary and conventional to use terms like that in thinking about Russia?
It depends where you go with this strangeness and foreignness. Do you go towards trying to understand, trying to communicate, try to understand cultural difference, or do you go towards just thinking of it as other and sort of reifying its otherness? For me, I'm very interested in cultural difference, but that is only important in order to communicate, really. And I think that, for instance, in Russia, there was a lot of anti-American propaganda. On the other hand, nobody believed it. In fact, people completely reversed it and were quite pro-American, at least in my youth. You know, we didn't believe anything that was in the newspapers, so it must have been this utopian, beautiful, wonderful land.
Tell me what it meant, Svetlana, what it means to you as an exile in cultural and political terms, and yet as a native Russian nonetheless, what does it mean to you to understand and speak about your country in what you call silences and half terms and half languages? In other words, the things that don't get said are as important as the things that do get said.
For me, it's very important to understand the double speak, to really understand how people communicate. And in Russia, there was an expression to understand each other with half words. Mm. And this half words implied a certain community, imagined community of friends, not the official commonality, who understand each other and shared the belief. And what mattered was really intonation, tone of voice, not what was explicitly said. So the such American expressions as being straightforward and saying what you mean would just appear to be politically suspicious, say, in 1970s, if you suddenly go visit your friends and say what you mean in front of the phone, which could have been tapped. So that would be seen simply as being not streetwise or provocative.
What has happened since what we call the fall of communism, Svetlana? What has happened in light of what you're saying now to conceptions of privacy, individual rights? I mean, is this mere language rhetoric that has no real basis in the reality of Russian existence on an everyday basis?
Well, many people made a lot of the fact that there is no Russian word for privacy. Mm. And in fact, even in 19th century dictionary, privacy is defined negatively. Private man is an egoist. So if you look at the sort of Russian mentality and Russian conceptions of personality, it's very different from American. Mm-hmm. It's not the individualism that's emphasized, but the shared communal aspiration. Of course, now you don't might not have privacy, you have privatization. And of course, there has been a lot of desire to develop more individual consciousness, individual rights, legal rights, which was a major problem, property rights, and so on. There was a lot of progress made there, if we could call it progress. Yet I do believe that Russian conception of personality is somewhat different, and it probably should be respected.
How does all of this translate, Svetlana, into what you do as an academic? On the one hand, you know, that's a world that's removed from the commonplaces of everyday life, but I take it that you find some basis there for your scholarship.
In fact, I never believed in the separation between academia and real world. Uh-huh. That separation struck me as very American.
Unlike most Americans.
Yeah. For me, it's an American cultural myth. Uh-huh. And I think it's very much was imposed on academics. And there is a new trend in academia, especially in humanities and also in social studies. Many humanists want to be public intellectuals. Mm-hmm. And so the return to personal voice, but also a combination of personal and critical use of personal story in order to perhaps illuminate larger historical narratives became very important.
You have a term for this. You call it autobiographical reading. That's one angle into the kind of work that you do as a scholar. You see yourself in the literature that you study. Am I right about this?
This term actually is not mine, it's Susan Suleiman's. There is a whole movement in criticism to introduce personal voice. I'm very interested in it, and I felt that for my project on Russia, I had to tell the reader what my position vis-a-vis the country is, that I was born in Russia and I also left Russia. So that complicates my perspective. But I do not believe in just using personal voice as a kind of confession to indulge and to tell the reader, become an academic exhibitionist.
What about the charge that because you use the personal dimension in your scholarship, that you're trivializing the large concerns of history and literature, that you are becoming only idiosyncratic rather than incisive and revealing the things that you write about?
Well, I think sometimes being idiosyncratic is actually very important. Uh-huh. It gives that precisely that individual, particular perspective that's absent from larger narratives, especially about Russia. Again, I'm interested to use personal narrative only as long as it is intertwined with larger cultural narrative. I'm not interested to tell about my personal psychology or my relationship with my father, things like that, to joke.
Freud's been done.
Yes, Freud has been done. But I'm interested to the personal anecdote allows me to tell the stories that have not been told and give more of an insider's perspective and feel to it, and precisely add idiosyncrasy instead of seeing Russia as a kind of homogeneous space.
Svetlana, what do you mean in your book and in your life, your scholarship? What do you mean by the term, the mythologies, the commonplaces of everyday life? How do they figure in your understanding of your native land?
When what I call myth is not, I don't refer to ancient mythology. Myth is a story, recurrent narrative, or a story that people tell each other in order to make sense of the world. I believe that myths are often cultural and historical, yet people naturalize them, take them for granted, think they're natural. So for me, the study of cultural myth is very important because it gives us an insight into cultural mentality and logic and cultural continuities. And I find that political scientists and former Sovietologists were particularly frustrated with the end of the Soviet Union because the whole value, you know, long-lasting value of scholarship was brought into question.
Right.
So looking at those mythologies allows us to understand larger structures of mentality. I don't think that it only is important in the study of Russia. I think also in the study of America.
Well, if you don't look at political issues, Svetlana, and if you are not a social scientist in the strictest sense, how do you make sense of your country in cultural terms? What kinds of ammunition and scholarly strategies do you bring to that enterprise?
I have to say that I do not separate cultural, political, and sociological.
Fair enough.
Of course, people who lived in the absolutist state and then in the Soviet state are dependent on the state. But they so I do not separate cultural and political. However, they figured out their own strategies of survival in that culture. And I try to look at everyday strategies of resistance and survival.
All right. Now, one of these strategies is your concentration on, help me with the phrasing here, living in an apartment, living in a sort of
apartment.
Communal apartments, that is to say, X number of feet or meters of space allocated to each individual human being. That sounds very abstract, and yet it has down-to-earth concrete repercussions for the way your life got lived before you left Russia. Tell me about this.
Many people who study Russia, many historians, concentrated on utopian projects of house communes, for instance, in their study of 1920s or on the utopias of the avant-garde. I wanted to see how utopias were practiced. So instead of looking at designs of communal home that never came to life, I looked at communal apartments that actually became the key Soviet institution. And they came into being in 1920s. The majority of urban population in Moscow and what was Leningrad used to live in a communal apartment, myself included, and the survivor of the communal apartment. It was a result of the housing crisis, but not simply a result of this housing crisis, but also it became a new Soviet institution, really a way utopia could be practiced in everyday life.
All right, now on the one hand, we have the word utopia, meaning we're striving for what? Beauty, truth, and happiness.
And no place. Utopia is
exactly.
No place.
And on the other hand, we have very unhappy living circumstances, to cut to the obvious here. Are we on the right track there?
They were unhappy livings. It depends certainly for whom. For people who came from military barracks, communal, the 9-meter room in the communal apartment was an improvement. For people who owned apartments, they became prisoners in one room of their own former apartment. What interested me was how, even in those difficult circumstances of imposed communality, people created private corners and their little private utopias by collecting souvenirs, private memorabilia, stamps, glasses, seashells, pictures. They created those corners that could be called displays of kitsch.
Was this viewed as a form of rebellion? Was this taken as a, you know, a sort of an affront to the purposes of the state?
No, I don't think it was an obvious rebellion. And I really wanted to look at unobvious strategies of resistance. They didn't go with banners to the Red Square.
The things that are underneath your nose all the time and yet speak powerfully.
It was more the strategy of survival and in that little private corner to cultivate some kind of little museum to private life, perhaps. And for me, that was very touching to visit those often old women in the communal apartments, photograph their personal little museums. And one of the women told me, this is my nature mort, which is still life. Mm. She used a term, artistic term, to characterize this little collection of, you know, everyday kitsch objects, everyday tacky objects. And for me, it was very touching.
Why are you interested, Svetlana, in what you call the tacky and the banal? And another term that you use here is just bad taste. How does that manifest itself in the commonplaces of everyday life in Russia?
I actually think that banality was much maligned in Russia, so I took a pro-banality stance. I wanted to figure out what is meant by banality. For instance, one Russian poet, famous revolutionary poet Vladimir Mayakovsky, in his suicide note wrote, "My love boat has crashed against the daily grind." Uh-huh. And this is kind of an amazing reason for suicide of the revolutionary poet.
And there's a term for that daily grind. What is
which
it?
Which is byt.
Yeah, one of these half-spoken important phrases.
Russian critics, Roman Jakobson, said that this word cannot be translated into Western languages because nobody else understands the resistance to everyday banality the way Russians do. So when I read that, I realized that it's not only suicide of one revolutionary poet that's at stake, but a larger cultural mentality.
Now, does this logic extend, Svetlana, into the 1990s when you look across the ocean and try to figure out what's going on in terms of high culture as well as popular culture in your native country?
What struck me even at the era of glasnost, that people talked always about public sphere and very little about private sphere. So a lot of the mythology was still there. There was also an attempt to go beyond it. There was, for instance, a newspaper called Private Life. Mm-hmm. It is very difficult to look at what's going on now, because I think since very now that we, during the victory parade, we saw Yeltsin standing on Lenin's mausoleum, I see it as a period of restoration. And it is a restoration of Russian Soviet mythologies, a restoration of national state, of national iconography. So I think we're witnessing a new period now of restoration of old myth.
What is happening? What do you think will become of that marvelous, rich literary inheritance that the Russian people look back to? I mean, you have all of these world-class writers in the 19th century that essentially defined Russians for themselves. They were forgotten or neglected, many of them, during the communist regime. Are they going to make a comeback now?
Well, literature was a form of secular religion in Russia. And in the 19th century, actually, it was said that Russians define themselves as community of readers of Russian classics. So it's not even an ethnic identity, but and community of readers of literature. It's kind of a wonderful definition if you think about it. But it was very much a literature-centric universe. A poet or a writer was a second government, according to Solzhenitsyn. You see lots of monuments to poets in Russian cities.
They were the popular culture for a long time.
In a way, they were a kind of popular culture. Children were brought on their daily walks to visit a poet, Pushkin, to bring little flower to Pushkin, instead of seeing Mickey Mouse, you know. Now, of course, Pushkin's monument is facing McDonald's in Moscow.
Oh, my goodness.
And there is Coca-Cola
on
the
other side. What a confrontation.
Pushkin doesn't mind. He seems to be enjoying it. I think what's happening now is literature is no longer secular religion. It is the end, perhaps, of that literature-centric universe. However, there are lots of wonderful writers. There are new centers for contemporary art, new Institute of Contemporary Art, Center for Contemporary Art, various non-profit organizations that, you know, appearing. They're much more decentralized and harder to find. And they're no longer sponsored. Many of the poets are no longer sponsored by the government. But there is actually quite amazingly rich literary and artistic life in Russia.
Well, when I hear you talk this way, Svetlana, on the one hand, I think that the fall of communism, quote unquote, has to mean nothing but good news for the Russian artist and writer and filmmaker, people like you. On the other hand, it opens the doors to what the critics in the harshest terms would call the invidious influences of mass culture from the United States or from the West. Do we have a contradiction there, or do we have a continuity?
That's a complicated question, because I think Western mass culture already since the 60s or maybe even late 50s was penetrating Russia, and it was seen almost as a dissident alternative culture. I remember when I was invited to the evening of Beatles, and then the police, this was 70. 8, then the police came and we were all thrown out of the building.
You mean the police, the rock group, or the police, the police?
I am afraid police, the militia, but right. The Russian militia.
Yeah.
So listening to Beatles or Jesus Christ Superstar was like a dissident act. So in a way, alternative Western popular culture was always penetrating Russia since the 60s. Now it's more commercial culture, Coca-Cola, McDonald's. I don't think it's bad per se, but I think it is important to continue sponsoring Russian films and alternative artists. There is much more diversity of mm-hmm. styles and movements.
Svetlana, in all of these comments, should I accuse you of what, a sort of form of nostalgia here for what used to be?
I'm proud to be nostalgic. I think every historian has to acknowledge and confront her or his own nostalgia. I believe there are two types of nostalgia. The word means homesickness. Home and longing are two roots of the word. First type of nostalgia is utopian, when one wants to reconstruct perfect homeland, perfect utopian homeland that never was. And we witness that utopian nostalgia in many nationalist discourses, Greater Serbia, Greater Russia, and so on. And nationalism is based not only on shared memory, but also on shared forgetting. So it's a kind of cultural, mythical, unreflective rewriting of history. Mm-hmm. And I think it could be very dangerous. My nostalgia, I hope, is ironic. So I'm confronting my own nostalgia. I'm thinking of my position as a cultural mythologist between two cultures.
So you are not looking back and longing for the good old days of bad old Soviet Empire, that sort of thing.
Not really. Of course, I'm nostalgic for my own imagined communities of friends, for a little bit of for my childhood. It may be more colored. My descriptions are more colored by affection. Uh-huh. But I don't think I want to reconstruct anything. But I want to say that there is a certain nostalgia for the old Soviet Union. Which also goes two ways. There are lots of films, for instance, and uh-huh. artworks that use old symbols in a kind of a way that was used by pop artists in America in the 60s. Instead of Campbell's soup, it's ham and sickle. Right. Ham and sickle and Campbell's soup, you know, to be more international. And there was a whole movement in cinema, kind of a ironic use of Stalinist symbolism, because Stalinism was the last grand style of socialist realism, you know. So there is an attempt to play with it, to exorcise the demons. But that's an ironic use of nostalgia. There is also another kind of nostalgia. For instance, when we see Yeltsin speaking on the top of Lenin Mausoleum, or when we see demonstrations of veterans with pictures of Stalin, or when you walk on the Red Square, you see Cossacks who are dressed exactly the way they were in the turn of the century. I thought they came from Bolshoi Theater, but unfortunately they didn't. But you see kind of monarchist heroes as well. So that is a dangerous nostalgia, because it's not ironic. It simply wants to recreate. It doesn't want to question history and forgetting.
Svetlana, how would you characterize your best hopes, your worst fears for your homeland, Mother Russia?
I don't even like the expression Mother Russia. I like just the country, Russia.
Mm-hmm. Is that gendered and sexist and inappropriate?
Not because it's gendered and sexist, but it, for me, is a cliché from either Soviet discourse. I remember mm-hmm. those huge monuments to Mother Russia.
Fair enough.
Or from this Russian nationalist discourse. I'd like to see Russia, a democratic state that preserved its own culture. And I want it to be to break away from two oppositions, either the restoration of Dark Age nationalism or a completely, you know, as they call it, another Hong Kong in Europe. I don't think those are two alternatives. I think we have to look for the third. And there is a Russian proverb, between two evils, look for the third. But so this would be my hope. Uh-huh. And I think it will take several generations.
Are you optimistic about the prospects for leadership, political and cultural, or cultural, bringing the two together to make these transformations occur?
Until about 2 years ago, I tried to be optimistic, just simply because apocalyptic narrative was so prominent that during my interviews on the Russian TV, I tried to sound optimistic.
Uh-huh.
Now I'm very cautious, and I think it's too early to say what will happen.
Svetlana, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. I'm going to ask you again to generalize here. How would you characterize the large differences between what you call the governing myths of our life, our everyday commonplace life in America, and life as lived in the former Soviet Union?
Let me tell you a post-Soviet fairy tale for the end. A satirist wrote that Russians recognize themselves in the folkloric character of Ivan the Fool. Ivan is a great hero. He loves to commit heroic feats, to kill the dragons and so on, but he doesn't know what to do with himself in between the heroic feats. So his monster is not the dragon, right, but the everyday life. And for me, this is a key fairy tale told by a post-Soviet satirist about Russian mentality, that it's this great struggle against everyday life. Russians define themselves, according to this fairy tale, as heroes who are ready for feats but not ready for the time in between. As for American cultural mythology, it really is based on American lifestyle, not on the opposition between spiritual culture and everyday life. It's based on everyday life. So for me, the importance of cultural studies is precisely to bridge the gaps between culture. I hope cultural studies would be cross-cultural studies. They would bridge the gap between humanities and social sciences, between academia and so-called real world, and help to understand cultures better. But maybe this is kind of a utopian version of cultural studies.
Svetlana Boehm is a writer, filmmaker, and professor of humanities at Harvard University. Her new book is Commonplaces, an account of the mythologies of everyday life in contemporary Russia. Commonplaces is available from Harvard University Press. Svetlana Boehm is also the author of Death in Quotation Marks, Cultural Myths of the Modern Poet. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Major funding for this edition of Soundings came from the Modern Language Association of America, which encourages the teaching and study of languages and literature. Audio cassettes of this program are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 781. That's $10, program number 781. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Next week on Soundings, writer Mark Helprin. He'll be here to read from and talk about his new book, a novel entitled Memoir from Ant Proof Case. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Commonplaces, a fresh look into contemporary Russia, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for a conversation with writer and filmmaker Svetlana Boehm of Harvard University. She says that understanding the real Russia has always been a challenge for Westerners, especially so since the fall of communism. But she also argues that new insights into Russia are available by looking at the commonplaces, what she calls the mythologies of everyday life in the former Soviet Union. Commonplaces, some answers and insights from writer and filmmaker Svetlana Boehm, this week on Soundings.